Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show we have Al Zambon. Al is a historian, a writer, and a podcaster. His podcast, if you care to look it up, I highly recommend it. It's called Historically Thinking, where he has guests on, which, as a full disclaimer, he has had me on his show a couple of times. So we've known each other through podcasts and guesting on podcasts and now on one another's podcast. So, Al, welcome to History 605.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be here. It's intimidating to have the microphone reversed, but I'm sure that I can talk even more than I do on my podcast.
Well, that hopefully the guest does more talking than the host. So that's perfectly okay. We do from time to time, despite the fact that History 605 is a podcast about South Dakota history or history of the Great Plains, with the ramp up to America 250, I've been doing podcasts about the founding of the nation, about the Declaration of Independence, and about the American Revolution. And your book on Daniel Morgan was helpfully recommended to me. And I read it over the past few days and really enjoyed it. Got a lot out of it. So I'm happy to have you on the show and where we can talk about this general, colonel, but also somebody who came out of the, as you phrase it, the colonial poor. So he's a perfect personality, I think, to read about and learn about the people who founded the United States and fought the war and then worked through and creating what we live in today in many respects. So I was really glad to read your book. What pushed you into writing this biography of Morgan?
Well, a lot of things. One of them was I just listening to a conversation between H.R. McMaster, the former National Security Advisor in Trump won. And he is likewise obsessed with Daniel Morgan. And he and I read the same book. It was from a series of small biographies for kids. It was something like, you know, Daniel Morgan, Frontier Rifleman or something like that. That's probably the first time I'd heard of him. I read some other books about him. But when I was about 10 or 12, I used to insist that my aunt take me to Valley Forge at least once a year. And she bought me Don Higginbotham's great biography of Morgan, Daniel Morgan, Revolutionary Rifleman, and which was his dissertation. And he wrote that 55. So when my agent, I even went as Morgan for Halloween once. No one had any idea who I was.
Mistaken for Daniel Boone or something like that.
Yeah, of course.
That.
Yeah. I was deeply disgusted. This is when I began to question the wisdom of adults. They might not know as much as I think they think.
That's right.
So when my agent called me, I remember where I was. I was looking at the Mississippi River and said, do you want to write a biography of Daniel Morgan? It's like, yes, I do. Then second thoughts, as I have about, you know, everything that I do, including like what to have for breakfast. And I looked into it and I realized as great as Higginbotham's biography is, it was like 50, 60 years old and a lot had changed in history, in the way that we do history, in the way we think about early America. So I could bring that to bear on the context, Morgan's context. Then I looked into Morgan and I resolved not to read Higginbotham's biography, but I started looking into Morgan and some of the earliest notes about him. And then I realized he was psychologically interesting. You know, as you say, and he was also socially interesting. As you say, I say he comes from the silent ranks of the colonial poor, and he does. Yeah. He is quite literally homeless. When he first comes into public consciousness, the earliest records of him, he's a homeless boy of uncertain age who shows up in Winchester, Virginia. Uh-huh. And then psychologically, because if you're going to write a biography about of someone, you better find them interesting as a person. There must be some sort of mystery about them. Mm-hmm. There's a mystery about all of us, to ourselves, but to everyone around us. As bland and as boring as people seem to you, there is some mystery within each one of us. And Morgan's mystery came early. It's when I realized he had never told his two daughters the names of their grandparents. Wow. And that like clicked for me. I don't think I made a big enough deal of this in the book. Sometimes.
No, I missed that in the book.
Yeah. And so that he was so angry at his parents for the rest of his life.
Wow.
Something happened that he would not mention their names. He ran away from home or left home. He uh-huh. never went back. There's no trace that he ever went back. There's some sentimental Victorian stories about him visiting home again. But the one sort of direct attestation from people who interviewed his daughters was he never told us their names. And I thought, Daniel Morgan, you are an interesting person. Yeah. There's something interesting about you with that anger. That must have been a deep red ball of anger somewhere yeah. in him, which made him a complicated person.
Yeah. He was born in the Pittsburgh area? Or I'm sorry, the Philadelphia area?
No one really knows. He both New Jersey and Pennsylvania have claimed it at various times. Again, okay. he never really said.
Maybe he never enjoyed the mystery.
He might have. I mean, this did not stop New Jersey from building a cabin on the site of the cabin where he grew up, which is complete a lie, in social science terms. But he, there's all sorts of stuff. He never said. He just never said. Some people say, "Oh, he was Daniel Boone's cousin." Again, he never said. How would you expect him to talk about his cousin's name if he never mentioned his parents' name?
Right.
What is known of his origin, says his first biographer, who's like his step-grandson, is that he had left after a fight with his father. He was uncertain about his age, maybe 17, 18, 16, 19, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
He had started walking. He had gone through Lancaster, spent 6 weeks in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, crossed over the Potomac at Williams Ferry. Or Williamsport, Maryland, and then ended up in Winchester. And that is as much as he ever... And oh, his parents were from Wales, which is, given that Morgan is the eighth or ninth most popular family name in Wales, is not a surprise.
Right after Jones.
Right after enough to beat the Evanses.
Yeah.
And that they had come over, I think, in the 1720s.
Okay.
He said all those things in, I believe the biographer says, in moments when he had forgotten himself. In other words, these tiny little crumbs were things that he let drop by accident.
Right.
Which is kind of amazing, you know.
Right.
Here's someone who's completely, to his children, is completely silent on the most basic questions of his early life.
Well, it would seem like he definitely built a life there in Winchester and in Virginia. And
he built an incredible life.
Yeah.
And that's the second thing that made me interested about him, because I'm, mm-hmm. A historian of the colonial South and of Virginia. Virginia has, up into the 20th century, probably up until the final success of the Civil Rights Acts in the late 60s, Virginia is probably the most hierarchical American society. The Constitution of 1901 didn't just deprive blacks of the right to vote. It deprived some whites of the right to vote.
Really?
1901.
There's still property qualifications then? How did they do that? Wow.
Property qualifications and other sort of things. And, in Deep South states, they worked around that to make certain that poor whites could vote. But Virginians didn't really care. I mean, the white elite Virginians didn't really care. It was a hierarchical society. And it's a hierarchical society for sure in 1755 or whenever Morgan shows up. Yet there are ways of rising within it. It's not like a sophisticated Roman, the course of honor, where you would do certain offices at certain times. But it is a little bit like that.
And but it was learnable, evidently.
It was learnable.
If you wanted to rise, it was a learnable system.
And like in any system like that, you need patrons. You need people who will offer you a hand up. You need to be supported by people. You can't pull yourself up by yourself. It's pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is well, it's kind of physically impossible. If anyone's tried it, they know that. But it's you certainly can't do it in the Virginia colonial system. So he has people who are sort of act as his patrons. You can tease them out from between the lines. You can see who he lives close to, people from who he buys land from. And, you know, he's also just damn lucky, which I hope I emphasized. He's engaged in, you know, he could have died in 18 ways by the time he was 30. I tried to count up once all the various violence that was done unto him. But it's also amazing the violence that wasn't done unto him. His first job is grubbing stumps, which means like prying stumps out of fields with an oxen, probably in a bar.
Yeah.
Hard job. Ox steps on your foot. You get your leg pinned in the stump hole.
Your kneecaps can be gone in an instant.
Gone in an instant. His second job, he's working at a sawmill, proverbially dangerous. And then within a year or two, he's a teamster for a wagon. Wagoners did not drive on the wagon. They walked by the wagon up until someone got the idea of putting a bench seat on. But that was not when he first started. He was still would have walked or ridden one of the horses. Horses, as anyone who spends time around them, they are essentially crazy. Yeah. They take us on sufferance. They also weigh half a ton. You know, there's a lot of ways for Morgan to have been injured or maimed. And, you know, if you're a manual laborer, as he was illiterate as well, you've got a certain amount of years before you have to do something else. Basically your best years it's like being a professional athlete. Your best years are going to be gone by the time you're 35.
Yeah.
But professional athletes have made money and manual laborers haven't. Yeah. So it's a race for a manual laborer like Morgan to find some other way to make a living before your body starts to fail you.
Right. Well, as you sum up toward the beginning of the book, when you kind of list all these things that you just now were discussing, and then you say, so his two greatest skills were his ability to do physical labor and his ability to make friends.
He made friends.
That pays off toward the back end of his career when he his first greatest skill of physical life.
My intuition is that was, you know, his greatest ability. And because people do seem to like him. They might find him, you know, a visiting French officer from the very height of the Enlightenment. He might find him a little crude, a little naive, but also ingenuous and delightful. And primitive in a way that in the 18th century, primitive is always a good thing. It means, you know, earnest. It means, you know, at the root of things. It's like the way things should be. It's primitive. And so if you can impress the Marquis de Chasteloup, you know, which Morgan does, also for his tactical acumen as a soldier and his honesty, well, that shows you that you've got a range.
Right.
You know, because he can impress the Marquis de Chateauneuf, but he can also impress sort of Sam Houston's uncle, also Sam Houston from Rockbridge County, Virginia. You know, he can impress all of them. Corporals to lieutenant generals in the French army.
Right. From privates to presidents.
That's right.
Grudging respect from Washington at certain points.
But Washington does have a beef with him for a while. I wouldn't say he ever got Jefferson's respect. He got Madison's vituperation and anger. For sure. But that's much later on.
Right.
That's late in the 1790s.
Yeah. Well, before we kind of discuss the flow of the war, which, by the way, he's kind of like Forrest Gump in the American Revolution.
He is the G.I. Joe
everywhere.
He is the G.I. Joe of the American Revolution. He is.
Let's talk about two material things which have kind of come up already. I'd like you to discuss the musket and the rifle and the difference between the two and kind of a brief cultural thing, because that, as you mentioned the title of the books use the term rifleman and so forth.
Yeah.
Which after reading your book, I kind of think, kind of, but not, hopefully not all the time, right? That gets you killed. And,
yeah.
And then also so, the Conestoga. I'd like to talk about Conestoga. The wagon.
Let's start with the Conestoga first. Okay. Conestoga wagon is named for like a lot of, like the rifle. And the Conestoga wagon and the rifle are both a beautiful combination of what happens when German and British, to a certain extent, arts come to Pennsylvania and Northern Virginia and Maryland in the, mm-hmm. the Great Valley of America, and they blend together. Uh-huh. So, and they create these wonderful cultural artifacts, which don't exist anywhere else. So the Conestoga wagon, which, you know, kind of becomes the prairie schooner later, very important yeah. for South Dakota. You've got this, you've got some aspects of the English wagons, apparently, some aspects of German wagons. But then you've got this gorgeous, you'll notice it when you see it. It's the one of the key things about it is the arc of the bed, mm-hmm. the way it looks like almost a curved boat. And right. I think that's really, and people come up with stupid stories about that. So that's like, you can use it as a boat. No, it's just, it's not so you can use it as a boat. It's because, you know, if you're an engineer, you say, oh, that's how you get, that's how you make it strong. It gives a, and it also has a great lines to it. I think it's for, there's some structural reasons and there's some aesthetic reasons for it.
Yeah.
As I said at the time, when Morgan is using sort of the proto Conestoga, you know, I'm no wagon expert, although I did read 5 or 6 books about it. I forgot most of it, but,
yeah.
At that time, it is strange. They didn't put a bench there, but there was no bench like you would expect at the front of the
yeah.
wagon. Yeah. There's some people had a little side bench that you could pull out in okay. front of the left front wheel, and you could sit
like
on it, you could perch
on airplane,
like a jump seat on an airplane, exactly.
Yeah.
But it would seem that you did most of your driving by walking or by riding on the, I believe the left wheel horse, the left front yes. wheel horse, and you would direct the other horses from that position. Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, to show if you were quite a fella, you would get on top of that jump seat and balance yourself on the jump seat. And I'm imagining, I like to imagine that's what Morgan did when he came down to Alexandria or to Falmouth or Fredericksburg, one of the port cities on the Potomac or the Rappahannock. I could imagine, of all people, that's probably what he might have done. He would have balanced himself up on that with the reins in his hands,
yeah.
you know, sort of like a surfer, right. as I imagine now. More likely he was riding on the left wheel horse.
Yeah.
So that's a Conestoga wagon, and that is absolutely important to his development. He drives a wagon for someone else and soon owns his own. I think he owned three, maybe by 1774, 1775.
Oh, okay.
So he's running a small freight operation. So
he's not quite a Vanderbilt, but he's in that line of, no. of freighting.
No, he is in the line of freighting. And the musket rifle distinction. Some people have complained. I spent too long on this in the book, but I might have. But part of my research for this was standing around or leaning against the wall in the gunsmith shop at Williamsburg and listening to visitors. And eventually you get so irritated that you end up writing about 3 pages explaining the difference between a musket and a rifle. So let me keep it simpler than that. Musket is what everyone is the gun, the typical gun that people had, a flintlock musket. It is a smooth bore, shoulder fired gun, a long gun. It can be ranged from anywhere from a barrel can be anywhere from 4 to 6 feet. If you're using it for hunting birds, you would use a longer barrel. That's more of a fowling piece. Why is it longer? Because it's more accurate. When it's smooth bore like a shotgun, you're putting typically shot and powder down the gun and you fire it and it rattles around. It literally rattles the barrel in the barrel as it comes out because it's smooth bore. And these are handmade bullets. So nothing is machine made. Everything is handmade in the 18th century. So the tolerances that we take for granted of a .0001, they right. simply don't exist and they won't for another 100 years.
Yeah.
So when you put one single lead ball down a musket barrel, it doesn't fit. I mean, it's too loose. So it literally rattles. So muskets are inaccurate. You have to shoot. Okay. You have to shoot from within 100 yards. So in many ways, I was just shooting with a compound bow the other day with a friend. And I was thinking, you know, this is about as good as a musket. So muskets aren't as bad as we make out. You know, most combat takes place within 200 yards. I suspect far more of it takes place within 100 yards than people like to think. Right. So muskets are far more effective, even as inaccurate as they can be, than we might think in our American folklore. And the other thing a musket gives you is a well-trained musketman can shoot 3 to 4 times a minute. So it's just like with a contemporary military. What do you privilege, accuracy or volume of fire? Well, everyone wants both, but if you can have just one, you want suppressive volume of fire. And that's what a musket gives a soldier. It's also simpler to make. A rifle, on the other hand, it's rifled. It has grooves, have been arduously cut into a barrel using hand tools.
On the inside of the barrel, which are the
hand tools, which are themselves marvels of craftsmanship. In addition to that, a wood stock has been formed in the Americas, typically from maple. And it has been decorated often with silver work. So one of my friends who is a gunsmith in Williamsburg would say there are about 8 or 9 different crafts involved in creating an American rifle. And it is an American rifle. It's not a Pennsylvania rifle. It's not a Kentucky rifle. These rifles only exist the way we think of them in America. They're longer, they're slimmer, and the caliber is less than German rifles initial prototypes have been brought over by German immigrants to Pennsylvania. So by the time Morgan's in the 1750s, there are rifle smiths established in Winchester. He would have had one of these new American rifles. And let's not get into how they all look different depending on what region, but you can tell the difference between Winchester rifles and other rifles. Okay. What does that give you? It gives you accuracy to as far over their open sights. Okay. No one has scopes. No one has optical sights.
Yep.
Nope. But of course,
no optics.
No optics. American soldiers haven't had optics until the 90s, really. But as the best way I can think of it, whatever you can hit with an M1 Garand, which in many ways is the sine qua non of American military rifle accuracy, because you can reliably hit a man at 400 yards of the Garand. Evidence is pretty clear you could do the same thing with an American rifle in 1775. So if you can see him, you can hit, with your bare eye, you can hit him if you know your rifle and know what it can do. The problem is, a good rifleman can only shoot twice a minute because not having bullets that fit a rifle perfectly, you have to get the bullet has to be a little oversized. It has to be wrapped in a waxed patch and you force that sucker down this long barrel to seat it in the rifles of the barrel. And that's how you get accuracy. So what you gain in accuracy, you lose in volume of fire. You lose in speed. And speed and volume of fire are, from 1775 to 2025, are what combat commanders really value. Yeah. More than accuracy. We had a brief moment in World War I or prior to World War I where we thought accuracy was everything, but that turned out to be kind of nonsense. We weren't as accurate as we thought, and it wasn't that important in a battlefield, which is really ruled by artillery. You know, in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Right. And it's important too, when you talk about the technology of the time, as you raise in your book, the fact that they're using black powder, which once fired creates all of this smoke and obscurity.
Black powder, like I think even modern gunpowder really doesn't explode, it burns. It just burns very, very, very fast.
Right.
Black powder burns a lot slower and it burns dirty. So it leaves a lot of residue in your gun, which has to be, especially if you're using a rifle with all those delicate rifling, that has to be cleaned out eventually. More importantly, for what you're talking about, if you ever go to a demonstration, if the wind's right and if they're firing enough, you'll start to see you can't see anything.
Yeah.
The battlefield must have been, if there's no wind, a battlefield is covered in smoke. And there are stories from the Napoleonic Wars of soldiers, of officers who are directing platoon fire, looking, you know, bending down to the ground, seeing, are the French still there?
Yeah.
You know, how would you know? Because how would you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the fact is, you fire rifles. If there's enough smoke on the battlefield, you won't have anyone to shoot at.
And that's also a telltale sign to the enemy where you are. Because they can say, well, I heard the sound, so where's the smoke over there?
Yes.
There they are.
Absolutely. Yep. And they produce a lot of smoke.
Right.
And there's a reason why, you know, black powder hunters today refer to them, their guns as smoke poles.
Yes. Yes. Well, all of that is just a kind of a good setup then for the tactics that Morgan winds up developing or implementing, exploiting. He understands the difference between the rifleman and the musketman. And
it's another important thing about the musket is that you can put a bayonet on it. It's not that you can't put a bayonet on a rifle. It's just that every rifle is handmade. It's a bespoke instrument made for the user. It's a custom piece of work. Could you have had a bayonet fitted on them? Yes. But the calibers are different. The lengths are different. The length of the rifle is usually based on the height of the owner. These are bespoke. It's like going and getting yourself a really high-end Dodge Challenger. It's kind of like that. It's a very high-end
custom seats for you.
Very custom. Yep.
Yeah.
For you in your color that you want. Muskets are standardized as best as anything can be standardized in the 18th century. Muskets are standardized. So they're all the same caliber. They're all the same, therefore the same barrel diameter. Therefore, you can order bayonets from a separate supplier and they will fit that load of muskets, which wouldn't be the case if they were rifles. This is important to understand.
Yeah.
And the bayonet's important in the 18th century. And there's a lot of argument amongst military historians. Do people use the bayonet? The answer is yes, there are bayonet wounds on the battlefield. People often flee rather than receive a bayonet, but I don't know what the percentage is, but people will receive and fight back with a bayonet. The people who won't fight back against a bayonet charge are people who don't have bayonets, because that's crazy. So what Morgan realizes at the Battle of Saratoga and at a skirmish at a place called White Marsh outside of Philadelphia is that if you have riflemen within a certain range of British regulars, light infantrymen who are fast, who can run the 40 in a very good time, who also are proficient shots, who are accurate shots with a musket, within 100 yards, they're deadly.
Yeah.
Then you've got a problem on your hands. So because you've got that problem of reloading, you've got that problem of your position being exposed by smoke. So what Morgan does in sort of the second battle at Saratoga, and I don't think this is an accident, even before the first battle, he had brought in a battalion of musketmen from the Continental Line to mix in or to fight alongside his riflemen. And in fact, the second battle, for reasons we have to get into, they got separated in the battle of Freeman's Farm, but at Battle of Bemis Heights, the second battle of Saratoga, he's using them basically as a screen, or for a right-handed fighter, he's got his guard up with his left. Those are the musketmen, and he keeps on jabbing with his riflemen.
Yeah.
And that's what he does when he's successful in battle using riflemen. That's what he does. He basically is, as you realize reading the book, and it took me a lot longer to realize, he's engaging what we call combined arms, in which he realizes that no single weapon or type of soldier can win a battle, let alone a war. You must intermingle them. Now that's very sophisticated these days. We've got drones, we've got UAVs, we've got aircraft, we've got all the things of war. In the 18th century, it's a little simpler, but it's still good to figure out, how am I going to use my riflemen, my musketmen, my cavalry, and my artillery, how am I going to use them in combination so that I can achieve my tactical goal?
Right.
That's a combined arms problem. It's on a much smaller scale, but the sort of the basic thinking remains the same.
Yeah. He is, it's kind of rock, paper, scissors, right? You play that game you're trying to guess what strength can I put against my opponent's weakness?
Yeah.
And when you do, when you array your forces in a combined arms way, you always have one strength you can deploy against a weakness. You're not caught short.
Morgan's what people consider sort of the finest, certainly it's the greatest American tactical triumph of the American Revolution is the Battle of Cowpens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's the only time that an American regular force wins against in a head up, straight on fight with it, a British regular force. And Morgan combines on his third, we don't have to get into the details of the fight, but then he combines both riflemen and musketmen from the Continental Line, the professional long-term soldiers. He combined them with riflemen from militia companies. So I think it's quite brilliant that he did that. That was like the sort of the apex of his tactical thinking, because now the riflemen, the militia riflemen without bayonets, are protected by the volume of fire and the bayonets of the professionals on either side of them. They're also steadied by these longer time serving troops. So he's right. Got this one line where he's got the benefits of both the volume of fire from the muskets and also the protection of the bayonets. But he's also got, if he needs it, he's got right. The sniping accuracy of riflemen if they can see what they're shooting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
So, and in fact, sometime during the Saratoga campaign, he realizes there's a British officer that's leading a unit that's doing very well, and he orders his riflemen to go right after that guy.
Yeah. And the even more telling, he has him go after the horses first.
Yes.
That's why all the artillery is captured. Because he mm-hmm. understands, he is a wagoner. He understands the importance of the horse, and which we don't always see that.
Right.
We don't see how important the horse was even to the German offensive in the Battle of the Bulge. Horses make armies
That's right.
go.
That's right.
And up until like 20 years ago. And the first thing Morgan, you know, that he wants to take is the logistic backbone of the artillery and of the army. So it's probably not very sporting perhaps, but it's easy target, but that's how you get hold of the enemy's artillery.
Well, he has a very sophisticated understanding of utility of all these different horses, the wagons, the different types of wagons, and the logistics lines, and having kind of grown up as a wagoner, he understands that the connectivity of commercial, business and mm-hmm. markets. He's right there at the ground floor of all that.
And yet he was illiterate. This one of my proudest moments in the archives was realizing that I could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that, you know, as late as 1766, he still was signing his name with an X, with Daniel Morgan, his mark. But by 1770, he could write a business letter. He is one of my favorite things about him. I think the most impressive things about him is that somehow he learned to read and write.
In his 30s, probably.
If I got in my 30s illiterate, I think I would just as soon stay that way. Who else knows? Who'll find out? I mean, but I think it's because of his desire back to climb that Virginia hierarchy. Mm-hmm. He knows that he can't be a Virginia office holder or a man of property if he is illiterate, like a lot of people, I wouldn't be surprised if he could read before he could write. That's pretty common. Those two things aren't connected together until I think the 1870 census. So he might have been able to read something, but without being able to form the letters. Yeah. But anyways, he's able to do both. And if he hadn't, he would not have been a brigadier general or a congressman, you know, as he was at the end of his life.
Let's kind of get into the war then and the campaigns. And
he
winds up, where's his first time that he is asked to form a unit in Northern Virginia? How does that come
about? He is because two or three of his great patrons are head of the Committee of Correspondence in Frederick County, Virginia, which is mm-hmm. Fredericktown was the old name for Winchester, Virginia. And they are people who have benefited Morgan. One of them is the pastor who married himself and his wife. in a proper church wedding. One of them is a business partner or has on and again, off again, business partner. They've also sued each other, but that's kind of standard in Virginia. You always have to sue each other. And then the third one was yet another fellow who Morgan's connected to. So when they are asked to by the Continental Congress, one of the first, there are three acts that the Congress takes in June of 1775 to create the United States Army. One of them is to adopt the New England Army that had been besieging Boston since Lexington and Concord in April. The second was to appoint George Washington, a Virginian, to the head of it. Okay. To make this a truly continental army, they right. not only appointed a Virginian, but they requested that 10 companies, I think 10, in the end, 12 or 14 were raised, or I might be wrong on that. They requested rifle companies be raised in Western Pennsylvania, Western Maryland, and in Western Virginia, where the mm-hmm. rifle was used. It's important to understand that the American rifle is confined to those areas. New Englanders have rarely seen a rifle. John Adams, his correspondence is quite clear. He didn't, rifle? I never heard of a rifle. Now, there have been rifles used in the Champlain Valley during the French and Indian War, mm-hmm. but I don't think most Bostonians would certainly ever heard of a rifle. They believe crazy stories about the accuracy of the Virginia men, riflemen, which the Virginians are happy to share. So that's how Morgan ends up at the head of a company, about 120 men. He was supposed to raise 80. I think he took 120.
Captain Morgan, though, was not the pirate.
No, different Captain Morgan. A big fan of rum, however. Can tell you from the storebook ledgers of the Shenandoah store in Winchester, Daniel Morgan enjoyed his rum. That is for certain. So he marched them in record time. I think they marched from Winchester.
Yeah.
They marched at a great speed, the beeline march
like
from Winchester.
Like 28 days.
Yeah, it was a good time. Because he put all the equipment and the packs in a wagon, and the wagons would leave before they left, and then they would catch up and then already have the campsite established. I mean, just good thinking.
Yeah.
They marched fast. They would do rifle demonstrations for people. They all did. Mm-hmm. They put on a show for all the New Jerseyans and New Yorkers mm-hmm. and New Englanders that they were marching by. So that was a really important moment in creating the U.S. Army, because this is why it's a continental army. They've now got Virginians and Pennsylvanians and Marylanders who have joined. It's not just a New England army now.
Right.
They were, however, completely, irreparably rebellious, and they're always getting in fights with each other. They're getting fights with everybody. None of them like garrison duty. Morgan doesn't like garrison duty. So the opportunity comes to invade Canada, and naturally he volunteers. Volunteers is core.
The temperament of young men leading to a disastrous decision. I mean, you take the rifleman. Oh, I'll just take him on campaign. We'll be doing something. Yeah. We'll keep him out of trouble. And then,
he kind of crashed on the rocks of Canadian. It's one of the great and it's one of the great unheralded, unknown marches in American history. Is over the height of Maine. Through a hurricane, through at least a couple nor'easters, at least. One Pennsylvania observer says Morgan he drives his men on to carry their heavy rowboats, their bateaus, until their shoulders are bloody and the skin's coming off and peels. And they carry them, and then they put them back in the water on the Canadian side of Maine, and they quickly get bashed on in the Chaudière River Rapids. Chaudière meaning boiling, which is why it's called Chaudière. The rapids. So, but nonetheless, Morgan's first combat in the Revolution is New Year's Eve, 1775, when he and the rest of the people assembled under Brigadier General Richard Montgomery and Colonel Benedict Arnold. Yes, that Benedict Arnold. Well, he wasn't then. He was one of the great American heroes.
That's right.
They led an assault on Quebec. Arnold has the bad luck to be shot in the leg with almost the first shot fired from the garrison. The second shot kills Montgomery and several people around him on the other side of the town. And before you know it, Morgan is more, he's not the senior leader, but he's trying to lead his people in an attack on Quebec in a blizzard. The ring is coming in around them. It's constant fire. And he is eventually forced to surrender, much to his, there are various stories about it. One that he surrenders to a priest rather than to a British officer. I don't know. That only shows up once. It's a good story, but who knows?
Yeah.
And then he spends, you know, 6 months in POW in confinement in a repurposed seminary in Quebec City, which becomes a prison for the officers, while and some of the men. So,
do they all get paroled, or just the officers get paroled?
They all. That's a good question. They all get paroled eventually. Yeah.
Okay.
And Guy Carleton, Guy Carleton, who's the British commander, is a very, very clever man. Mm-hmm. He makes sure that they all are paroled. He talks to all the soldiers individually, that they're fed as best as he can. After a relief comes in May, the whole city is halfway to starving. But they get the, okay. I think they get the same rations as everyone else in Quebec City. Carleton's very clever. He understands the politics of revolution in a way that few British or American commanders often fail to understand. And so in fact, Morgan and other officers are horrified by how well other Americans are speaking of Carleton. But they are paroled, and they arrive at New York Harbor just as the British are winning the Battle of New York.
Right. So they get there and they see Washington is essentially figuring out, do I burn the city? Do I leave?
The best argument these days is that actually he did burn the city, or at least Nathaniel Greene burned the city, one of them, because although they did it, they were unsuccessful. They only burned about, 20% of it. If they had burned all of New York, that would have been a real hitch in the giddy up for the British Army. But yeah. they do land at Elizabeth, New Jersey, or I think within eyesight of the burning. And Morgan visits Washington's headquarters, but he's on parole in the 18th century. That means you cannot fight or really go near anything military. And he's on parole for another 9 months, I think, until the mid-spring, maybe March or April of 1777.
And is he honored that parole? He's put on the penalty box for...
Well, kind of. He was essentially raising a Virginia, I think the 12th Virginia, whatever Virginia regiment that Washington appoints him to command, but doesn't announce it. So he's jumped him from captain to colonel. It's good.
Okay.
Nice. It's pretty good, but you know, he's deserving. Yeah. And he doesn't announce it because Morgan's on parole.
Okay.
I think he told Morgan. It's pretty clear because Morgan's recruiting people, which I don't think he was really allowed to do under parole. But, you know, Winchester, Virginia is about as far away from a British unit as you can get and still be within the bounds of, you know, of the commonly settled United States at the time.
Emotionally, though, the arc, he leaves Boston after Bunker Hill. The British take a pasting, goes through this campaign up to Quebec. The slog, the blizzards, the defeat, imprisonment, parole.
Yeah.
Lands in New Jersey, sees the disaster going on across the river in New York City, and says, "Hey, I'll raise a regiment and keep at this." I mean, he could have just said, "I'm out, I'm done. The whole country is going to heck. We're just going to go back to Britain."
He could have said that, and there was other reasons for him to say it. You know, a lot of officers find it very difficult to serve the entire war. They're not getting paid.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's another.
That sounds like, they should just serve for the love of their country. Well, Morgan has two young daughters and a wife. Washington has the wherewithal to go into immense debt, but not many people have Washington's wherewithal. They don't have his. They don't have his land holdings, and they haven't married. They haven't married the widow of the richest man in Virginia, or the second or third richest man. So not everyone can do that. And so there's a reason a lot of politicians and soldiers at various points in the revolution, excellent book about this by Laurie Glover. They have to leave because they just have to keep their family going. Right. And this actually hits Morgan at several points. You know, he just doesn't have the money to even get food to have fellow officers at his table, which is a hospitable, yeah. you know, Virginian sure. Or adoptive Virginian. This irritates him greatly.
So when you think about muskets and rifles, you also have to think about militia and regular units.
Right. Or regular units. Regular regiments eventually are serving for 3 years. You enlist for 3 years or the duration. State troops, there's a rank, people often, there are a kind of a special, usually former Continentals, former mm-hmm. regulars who need the money and who are enlisted by their, one of the 13 states in a longer term regiment. Maybe it would serve for a year. And then you've got militia, which come out for a very limited term, say a month to 2 months. And yeah. it's important that they not serve longer than that. This is an agricultural society.
Right.
If you serve longer than a month, what is going to happen to your crops? And right. that impacts not just you, but the entire cause. Who's going to, if those crops will feed people, including the Continental Army. Right. Wherever the Continental Army goes, it's about 10,000 to 20,000 men at various points. That Philadelphia is the largest city in the United States at 22,000 people. So the Continental Army is always the second largest town in the United States. And it must be fed. And latrines
and
must be dug. And the horses, they yeah. which eat it, being horses, are not only out to get you, but they eat a ridiculous amount.
Yeah, as, they eat like know, a horse.
As South Dakotans know. So this is Washington's basic logistic problem right. that he's suffering through all the time. He's mayor right. of the second largest town in America, yeah. which has a lot of horses, probably more horses than Philadelphia.
And then the smallpox hits. And his disease management is really quite
disease management. You know, public health for the Continental Army is it's not an overlooked topic, but I wish more people appreciated it.
Right, right.
But Washington's smallpox management and disease management is very sophisticated.
Yeah.
He's way ahead of his time. But latrine management, I mean, the reason why they moved out of Valley Forge is they couldn't dig any more holes.
Yeah. There was no more latrine room.
And this right. is just a fact of life. This is a right. fact of 18th century life, fact of modern right. army life too.
Yeah. It's 10,000 guys for breakfast, lunch, and dinner and their horses.
That's right.
It's quite the challenge.
And no one to buy the manure either, unlike in Philadelphia, because there you need it for your garden. There's a market for it.
But there is a market for manure. But
not in Valley Forge, not at any of the Continental Army camps.
As readers of the book will find out, and as we've talked about, Morgan is kind of pops up in a lot of these different key battles and so forth. But let's go to the cowpens where he's
so he is known. He is out of combat for a year. He is upset. There is a light infantry brigade is being formed from some of the best units of the regular army, from the Continental Army. And light infantry you look for the youngest, most intelligent, most athletic, and literally light, small guys, small, wiry, smart guys. Grenadiers, people built like me, slower, ready to go through a wooden door with their head first. That's a grenadier. they're sort of, assault troops. And light infantry are your scouts and uh-huh. your people who need to use their judgment. And Washington decides to finally raise every regiment of the army will have its company of light infantry. And mm-hmm. as the British Army has historically done on campaign, those companies all join together to form basically a brigade of 1,000 to 3,000 men, or two, if you're lucky. They never have that many. Yeah. So it's more like 1,000. Morgan says, I'm the guy to lead the brigade of light infantry. I mean, hello. By this time, he's shown at Saratoga what he can do as a leader of light infantry. Mm-hmm. But for various reasons we don't have to get into, promotion is not about experience. It's not about qualifications. It's about state politics, and that's necessarily so. All 13 mm-hmm. states have to be kept sweet. And one of the ways that you do that is you make sure that no state has more generals than another state. And there's no way in hell, theologically speaking, that George Washington is going to have a guy from Virginia made a brigadier general. To show, that would show favoritism on his part, which he will not tolerate the perception of. So Morgan loses out to someone who is not as well qualified as him. He's very upset, and he resigns. He resigns in a huff. And he must have spent a long time on his letter, because it's really, and maybe someone helped him with it. But Washington is disgusted with this. It'd be one thing if Morgan had left to go home and take care of things and just explain that. But instead, he's leaving because his wounded honor. And Washington will have none of that. And he speaks up until, I mean, even after Morgan shows his stuff later on, as we'll discuss, Washington's still irritated by this. Anyway, things go completely pear-shaped, as our English allies would say, in South Carolina by June of 1780. We have the taking of Charleston that captures about 5,000 troops. That'll be the biggest, it's the third, I think to this day, the third worst defeat of the United States Army following Harper's Ferry in 1863 and Corregidor, Bataan. Oh, yeah. The big, really big. But still, yeah. it was a huge POW haul. That and then the failure at Camden in June means there are no American regular troops south of the Potomac, I'm pretty sure. Maybe there's a few in Virginia. But basically the Southern Army of the United States to serve that department of the Continental Army has been destroyed. Morgan gets a summons from his commander at Saratoga, Horatio Gates, to come on south with him. He's still waiting to hear if he's going to be promoted to brigadier general. Mm-hmm. But I got to say, this is my favorite Morgan, one of my favorite moments in Morgan's life. He goes, he hears about the disaster. He takes a horse. He sells a horse to pay for his journey because he doesn't have cash. So he sells it in Richmond or Williamsburg. And he goes south. He goes to the sound of the guns. He goes to where he's needed. And Gates puts him in charge of the light brigade for the Southern Army. Gates is replaced in early December by one of the great, I believe one of the great American generals in American history, Nathanael Greene. Mm-hmm. And Greene does not discard Morgan. He could have seen Morgan as probably a pal of Horatio Gates. Greene and Gates do not get along, but for whatever reason, Greene sees something in Morgan or trusts Morgan. And so Greene then does something that they tell everybody at every academy not to do, which is split his army in the face of the unified enemy. The British Army is like in Upper South Carolina. It's all in one cohesive piece. It's not really, but it sort of is. Greene says, okay, now I'm going to divide my army. Now he has to because he needs food and horses eat a lot. And they're in Charlotte, what's then Charlotte Courthouse, now Charlotte, North Carolina. And Charlotte has been fought over for 6 months, and there's nothing left to eat there by either man or horse. So he splits the army to go to places which have been relatively untouched. Greene knows this is a violation of the basic laws of war, but he's also enough of a professional to realize that people have to violate the basic laws of war all the time because he's not a first-year cadet.
Yeah.
And he also realizes what's going to happen, that if he splits his forces, Cornwallis will have to split his forces. And that's what happens. Okay. And to confront Morgan, who's sort of swinging around into Western South Carolina, Cornwallis sends 1,000 men under his hardest charging, fastest commander, Bannister Tarleton, who, if you're a South Carolinian, Tarleton's still a bad name. It's not a good thing to call anybody. Tarleton looks for Morgan. Morgan is by that time that he, by the time Morgan realizes that Tarleton is chasing after him, he's already retreating towards the North Carolina border because of lack of forage for horses. It's always about horses. And as they retreat, Morgan starts to look for a place to meet Tarleton. He's sort of unconcerned about the fact of Tarleton. He's determined to fight him. And he finds a place at one of the many, meadows or sort of open meadows, savannas in South Carolina, all of them called cowpens, cowpens here, cowpens there, or cowpens everywhere. And so he meets him on this particular cowpens, which is now the cowpens. But at the time, there's one every 5 miles because cattle is a big business in South Carolina, in colonial South Carolina. And that's where I'm a historian, so I'm very bad with dates. January 19th, 1781, Tarleton attacks at dawn. And an hour later, Tarleton leaves the field with about 50 men on horses, and the rest are dead or captured. Wow. It's just the most complete victory. As Morgan says to his friend Ed Snickers back in Winchester, I gave them a devil of a whipping.
So how does he do that? I mean, the double envelopment, right? From the Kenai.
He did a double envelopment more or less by accident.
Okay.
He set out essentially, depending on how you count, he set out about 3-4 lines. He put out sharpshooters way in front. He then had lines of militia commanded by Andrew Pickens, one of the great Southern guerrilla commanders. Yeah. And then his sort of final line was this mixture of riflemen and Continentals and some state troops who had all had previous Continental service. So probably all of them in that third line had 3 years of experience following orders, which is important.
Okay. So they have some staying power.
He's also got cavalry. He's got 60 to 90 regular cavalry. Cavalry hasn't been a part of the American Revolution really until this point. There are a lot of reasons for that. We don't have to get into that, but he's got them. Even the night before, he's taking state troops who can ride. And most of the militia have their own horses. That's how they get from battle to battle. But if they can ride and they seem clever enough, they're given a sword. So that he's actually, it's kind of a last minute thing.
Kind of dress but them
they,
up,
is it? It's clever. William Washington, who's like the second cousin of George Washington, is the cavalry commander, and he wants mass in his charge. He's actually going to give actual cavalry charges, which again hasn't really happened in the Revolution up to that point. But the cavalry turned out to be invaluable to the entire thing, to the victory and to the pursuit that occurs after the victory. Okay. So it's a kind of a collapsing bag defense. Sharpshooters fire. They fire a couple rounds. They move back. And you think about smoke again. Firing a couple rounds makes sense because if you fire more, you start to get a lot of smoke in front of you. You can't see. So they fire a couple rounds.
Yep.
Come back to the militia line. The militia line seems to have stood its ground for at least 15 minutes, which is a lot of rounds. They might actually have shot their cartridge boxes out. It's about 40 rounds in a cartridge box. If you're firing four a minute, South Dakotans can do the math. 15 minutes, if you got a 40 round cartridge box, 15 minutes is about all you could stand if you have a slow rate of fire. They fall back. And the idea is they pass through the line of that third line. So sharpshooters, South Carolina, Georgia militia, then finally Virginia state troops, riflemen, and Continental regulars, all from Maryland and Delaware.
Okay.
Which are probably the best Continental regulars, the best regular troops in the American Army, period, at that moment. They meant men with most of them. Lots of them have 5 years of experience. The Delaware guys have been fighting since 1775. So, it's been a hard service for them. They burned all their tents in 1776. So there's a misapprehension of orders. At one point, that third line is trying to refuse its flank. Tarleton has sent in his reserve, and it's going to attack the American right. That's the right as you're facing the British. So a commander on the right wants to refuse the flank. That means bend it back in 18th century tactics so that they can resist a attack, so they won't get a fire running down the line onto a person's side. That's misunderstood, and the company who's been ordered to that starts to retreat. So then the rest of the line is ordered to retreat. So they're marching back. And Tarleton then sends everybody in all at once. The third line, is Morgan comes up quite in a snit, but he's tells them, they confer with John Eager Howard, who's the commander of the Maryland line, of the Maryland troops, and also commander of the third line. And they agree where that third line will stop and where it will turn and fire. They do. The British are, as they have succeeded, as they think they're succeeding, they've broken formation. They're everywhere. And they get a blast of musket fire at about 50 yards. I mean, basically point blank range.
Yeah.
And then they get the charge of the bayonet. And the Maryland and Delaware guys are experienced enough. They know how to deliver a charge of the bayonet. Mm-hmm. So the British are getting a taste of their own medicine. This is Continental Army soldiers who over 5 years have learned to be as good as the best British unit. And that collapses the British. Then the cavalry are charging in from the rear. The militia have recovered. They're starting to fire from another flank. And lo and behold, you've got a double envelopment. But that's Morgan's luck. That is Morgan's insane luck. This is not something he planned for. Yeah. You know, I think he probably had the idea that that third line would hold, it would engage in a slugging match, and then the militia would rejoin, extend that line longer, and then, mm-hmm. you know, and then win a straight up fight. But mm-hmm. instead, he's got a double envelopment on his, and that's the Cowpens. And then, as I said, at the end of it, only about 50 to 100 of the British cavalry escape, maybe 150, but something like 900 of the British Army's best soldiers are taken as prisoners or killed. And what's even more amazing is everyone's off the battlefield by noon. I mean, because Morgan has got them. He's worried about being pursued by the main army.
Okay.
He sends troops to pursue Tarleton, but his main thing is to get across into North Carolina, across the rivers, because many rivers between him and the main British army commanded by Lord Cornwallis.
Uh-huh.
And so he's got singularity of purpose. He is not standing around. Uh-huh. They do everything they need to do really in the next 3 hours. And then they're, you know, stuff is on wagons and they're marching. You've just won a decisive victory. Congratulations. Now march for 20 miles.
No time to pop the cork on the champagne bottle.
None whatsoever. In the best tradition of the military, you know?
The chapter Race to the Dan is kind of then this opens up that thing.
You
tested my understanding of rivers in the American Southeast.
Really important. The map's not good enough, I'm afraid, to even decipher all the rivers. But it's important. But we're really, I mean, I'm afraid we went too long on that. But all right.
Well, I think it's important. It's a great story. Morgan then finally, out of years of, I guess, as we'd say about horses being rode hard and put away wet, he has to go home to recover for several months.
He misses, basically by the time they get to Guilford Courthouse, which where there'll be a battle a month later, mm-hmm. which is where mm-hmm. Green and Morgan's two detachments, where they finally meet together, which is, you know, 2/3 of the way across North Carolina, taking a while for the army to reconstitute itself. Morgan is broke. In fact, it seems it's pretty clear to me from the letters, he almost died getting back to Virginia. There's one period where he's like, I think in bedridden for at least a week, maybe two. And when he gets home, he's still in a bad way all up until April. He has these moments where he like is basically has blackout migraines or something weird is going on with his body. I mean, who knows what? I never asked a doctor about it because how could they possibly diagnose a patient who's been dead since 1799? Right. But it's not good. His health is touch and go for a couple months.
Yeah.
Two, I must emphasize his explosive regret. He is so frustrated. He's beyond frustrated. Yeah.
To have been there almost, I mean, he's a part of almost every major thing except for Lexington and Concord and Boston right there at the beginning. And then to miss Yorktown, the big
He's back in the field in lower Virginia, in Tidewater, Virginia, in the summer of 1781, but gets sick again. and then can't be at Yorktown, you know, to be in at the death. He would have loved to have been in at the death, but his body could no longer handle it.
His post-war life is also interesting. And as you said, he winds up serving one term in Congress. Was that the first Congress?
No.
Okay.
It was, if I recall correctly, it was the first Congress of the Adams administration.
Of the Adams,
1796 and 1798. He votes for the Alien Act, but feeling poorly, so he's not able, much to his explosive regret again, he can't vote for the Sedition Act, which he was really looking forward to doing.
He's an Adams Federalist.
He's a Federalist. He's an anti-Jeffersonian Virginian, which is one of the reasons why he doesn't succeed in the posterity game. Virginians couldn't tolerate him as a traitor. But, you know, lots of Valley people in the Shenandoah Valley. And basically, he's an internal improvements Whig before there were internal improvements Whig.
Right.
He believes in canals and roads and mills and all the rest of it. That's been his life. That's his business.
It's amazing how... Well, maybe not amazing, but I guess as the Republic is starting, that's kind of one of the major domestic issues. Is it a public responsibility to build roads, bridges, canals, and so on?
Yeah, it's a huge, it's a responsibility much earlier than people realize, I think. It's an argument, a dispute.
Well, and it's a debate that continues. I mean, the first bridge that's built across the Missouri River in South Dakota, Yankton, South Dakota, to across the river in Nebraska, was privately funded.
Right.
The people of Yankton raised the money themselves, and they did so 100 and 105 years ago. And so that public improvements debate, you see that in early South Dakota statehood politics.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it doesn't go away. It's gone away. It's going to come back as very shortly, I have no doubt, in a big way.
Well, Al, what have you got cooking next? And you point people toward your podcast as well.
I point people to Historically Thinking, which they can find at www.historicallythinking.org. It's now a Substack. Material comes out once a week. Podcast drops on Wednesday. We actually have doing a sort of questions, a synopsis and questions on Friday, because I haven't quite shook the classroom out of my head, so I have to ask questions about it. And we got 420 episodes going back almost 10 years, or going back 10 years. Yeah. So there's a lot of content, as they say in Hollywood.
Yeah.
A lot of stories. And if you like this podcast, you're going to find plenty to like on Historically Thinking. And I'm working on finishing a book on the Battle of Kettle Creek, which happened on Valentine's Day, 1779, in Georgia, about halfway between the Bulldog Stadium in Athens and the first hole of the Masters.
Okay. Yes,
neither of which were there at the time the battle was fought. And it is a battle which even I didn't really know that this battle existed, and I'm supposed to be an expert on these things. I mean, I knew name, but it's turns out to be a fascinating little vignette.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that. Well, Al, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're very welcome.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruer for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.